This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 124. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today I'm joined by Darren Meller and Jeff Harmon. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm glad to be back after a couple of weeks in Italy. I have been listening to the show, and sometimes people have been saying stuff, and it's like, oh, I wish I were there to jump in on this or that topic. So I'm glad to be back. But I did get a lot of videos for the new beginner class that will be coming out pretty soon. And if you've already purchased the beginning photography class, fear not. You'll always get the updates, and so we'll push those updates out to those who have already purchased the previous version. But we want to start by jumping right in with a few questions that you guys have been submitting at improvephotography.com. We have our Q&A section where you can submit questions and people are answering them in there. It's really turned out to be pretty lively. We didn't want to have a forum on the site because, oh, you got to log into those. Very icky. Nobody likes that. But we have this Q&A section that's been really good for the people that have been using it. So, Jeff, what kind of questions have you seen in there that were interesting to you?
All right, this question comes from our good friend Anonymous. And
I love that guy.
Yeah. Said, I've just noticed the SanDisk Extreme Pro SD cards come in two versions. There's a 95 megabyte per second and a 280 megabyte per second card. Has anyone used the new ones? Do they offer any improvement? Is it worth it? Is the general gist of it? My answer is, it could be if you want to invest in something that you're future-proofing, but your current camera, unless you're using something that's a bit more modern, like the Micro Four Thirds, some of the Panasonics, they can take advantage of, but most of the others won't be able to leverage it. It won't matter. So it's not going to be bad. It won't be negative. You won't get anything slower from buying the 280 megabyte per second cards, but your camera won't go any faster either. It's limited by what the technology in there for how it reads and writes to the cards. That said, I'm a very big fan of future-proofing, buying something now, that 280 megabyte per second card, for being able to use it in the future. Eventually, you'll probably have a new body, and it will, you know, take advantage of it, I'm guessing, especially when it comes to 4K video. That puts a lot of demand on the write speed of the card, and so if you have the faster card, you're ready. But it depends on how fast you're going to upgrade. I don't recommend you really use cards more than 3 years. It's actually a recommendation I've written on the site before, some articles where when you buy the card, I recommend you use like a permanent marker of some kind to write the date, write the month and year when you got it. And then if it doesn't die before the end of 3 years, by the time 3 years rolls around, go get a new card. Go buy another one. And keep them in rotation. So it depends how fast you're going to update your body, I think. And if you can find it on sale, hey, go buy the faster one so that you're ready if you do get a card that can, or a camera that can go faster.
You're way more organized than I am, Jeff. I just go by the scuff test. As soon as the label on the front is starting to look kind of worn, yeah, I'm going to need a new card. But yeah, that's a good recommendation to write the date on it. I guess I'm a little bit different. I would approach this a little bit different. I would definitely skip the 280 megabyte per second card and just stick with the 95. If there's a camera that can take advantage of the 280 megabyte per second card right now, it's a rare one. And mm-hmm. You can check in the back of your camera manual to do it. My personal thought on future-proofing, and I guess that's why it's fun to have more than one person on the podcast, is so that we can disagree on these points, is I always like to be one step back from the bleeding edge on really any kind of technology. In fact, that's one reason that I really like Apple devices, is they're not bleeding edge ever. It's rare that Apple invents something that's brand new and blows everybody out of the water in terms of the raw technology behind it. they're usually one step behind. You know, you look at the specs of a high-end Windows computer, it's always a step ahead of the comparable Apple. Apple waits till a chip, anything is a little bit more got the bugs and kinks worked out, and then they'll start to put things out. And that's kind of my approach to technology. As much as I love the new stuff, I always like to wait one more generation until it's close to mainstream is when I like to jump on technology. And I find that's when I have the fewest problems. And not to mention, you're going to pay a lot of money for that 280 megabyte per second card, and you may never have a camera that can take advantage of it. You may wear the card out before that point. So I always take one step back. It's usually a little bit less expensive and usable. But that's not to say that it isn't worth updating your cards, because as I look when we're doing the workshops and stuff, like 90% of the cards that I see are just way too slow for the camera. That the card is the bottleneck, because people go on Amazon and they're buying on price. You know, you're like, oh, 32 gig card, buy. And you don't look into how fast it really is, or you fall prey to the marketing of the cards. It's very confusing and you're not really sure if it's faster or not. You haven't really looked at the numbers that actually matter. I don't know. It's definitely worth updating your card. I think in this particular situation, I personally would wait.
Yeah, and I'd watch for those sales on Amazon. They have them a ton, where there's like the daily deals that they have on Amazon. Mm-hmm. It happens probably at least twice a month that they have good, high quality, really fast cards, like even the 95 megabyte per second ones, for like half off.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the time to go get one.
Good point. Darren, what question did you find?
Well, we had a user. He definitely is appreciative of the fact that we've taken a lot of time to review Print Labs over at Improved Photography. And they asked how...
Yeah, that's improvedphotography.com/print test if you're looking for that.
Yes, it's very informative. And this user asked us to compare how those Print Labs we've reviewed in the past compare to Costco. And I've never actually printed at Costco before. I've had friends and family that printed at Costco. Unfortunately, I cheat on Costco with Sam's Club. So I do some prints there. And when I print with Sam's Club, I think the pictures coming out, they're looking okay, but they're not something that I would personally give to a client or something that I would show as far as, you know, if I had a portfolio book or something along those lines. But prior to recording, we were actually talking with Jeff about this, and he is a little bit more well-versed with Costco. What's your experience with that, Jeff?
So I've done a lot of printing through Costco. It's mostly a convenience factor for me. I don't have to send them off and wait for them to come in the mail. I can send them off to be printed today and pick them up this afternoon, you know, morning to afternoon, something like that. And they have some more advanced kinds of features than a lot of big box stores do. You can actually download ICC profiles, and then in Lightroom, you can export to those profiles so that the color accuracy will be improved when they get printed. And they go through every 6 months and rerun those profiles in all the labs. So that helps. And then the Canvas stuff does take longer. They don't do that in-house at the store. They send that out to a pro lab to have that done. And then they mail it to you in a great packaged container. It's awesome. I've had very, very good results on my landscapes using the Canvas prints and doing prints for my family portraits. The customers have loved them.
Yeah, that's good. I did not include Costco in the head-to-head blind test that we did comparing a bunch of different print labs. And for those of you who are international listeners, and there are a lot of you, probably maybe don't even know what Costco is. But you can go check out at improvephotography.com/print test to see how all of the online labs did, and many of them are available for international sales as well. Costco, I've seen a lot of prints from there, and they're certainly the best that I've seen from any local print shop. You know, compared to the Walgreens, the Walmarts, it's light years ahead. I would not put it on the level of a Pro DPI or a Miller's that does, I mean, really good high-end printing. The cost at Costco is decent. Is it a lot better than Pro DPI? No, and in fact, sometimes it's a little bit more depending on what you're printing. But I don't know. There are benefits and drawbacks to it. I would say it's the best of the local ones that I've seen, but I wouldn't put it on the level of some of those others, just in my personal opinion.
Yeah, and I can actually wait a day. I mean, Miller's, I can't tout them enough. And I mean, when it comes down to Miller's, I love the fact that they're overnight shipping for free. I just have to order $10 worth of product at my cost, and boom, it's ordered. If it's that same day, it ships out, and it's at my house the next morning via FedEx overnight. So I can't really beat that. And even with our print test, I'm not sure what experience you guys had with their customer service, and I'm not plugging Miller's. You know, they didn't pay me to say this, but every time I've called them, I've had someone on the phone who's extremely pleasant, extremely helpful, and very eager to help me out and make sure that my mind's at ease with every print order I put out.
Yeah, and that would certainly be a difference between Costco. You're not going to get any of that with the photo labs there.
They're like, no, but we have corn dogs for $2.
That's right. But, you know, Jim, to be honest with the Pro DPI, that one, as a hobbyist, when I went to go check it out because of your recommendation, I felt intimidated because very, you know, they brand it as something that's like, hey, this is only for professional photographers. You don't do your little family prints here.
Yeah, it is intimidating. I've talked to the owners of Pro DPI about that actually a couple times and really encouraged them to change that. They're afraid that if they make it clear that any photographer can print there, that it's going to alienate professionals who don't want their clients to just print the photos themselves. I think that's a misplaced fear, but I did talk to them and I asked them specifically, and they did say for sure that any photographer can print at ProDPI. You don't need to be a professional. You don't need to be experienced. Anybody can. The ordering process is a little bit better. They had an update a couple months ago that makes it a little bit better, but it's still very clunky compared to something like Costco or compared to even Miller's. So I don't know, the benefits and drawbacks, but my opinion is if you're in the United States, it's worth getting set up just one time with Pro DPI. Just say, this is going to take me an hour. I've got to get approved, whatever. Just deal with it one time, and then you have the software on your computer. It's easy to order prints after that. But yes, it is intimidating, and there are I really wish they would change that.
So I mean, we're going a lot on this question, but one more question for you, Jim. Do you do ICC profiles and download them, and do they refresh them, or how does that factor in? Do you worry about that?
I don't worry about it at all because I've ordered from all the labs with no ICC profile, and I've tried with. And as long as my screen is calibrated, I know for sure that those at the top of the list, you know, the Millers did really well, Nations did well, ProDPI did well. Grab one of those at the top of the list, and they were all so close. I mean, we were really splitting hairs between those top prints. There was a pretty clear divide between a really good print lab, a lot of them in the middle. That actually, one of the things that surprised me that made the prints really not good was not the color, was the sharpness of the photo. And we ordered on the same paper, everything, to make it as equal as possible. And there were a lot of the labs that just the photo looked soft on the print, you know, and it was the exact same file, everything. The color even looked good on some of them, but they just looked soft. And so I was surprised. I've never really concerned myself with the sharpness of the actual way that it's printed out, but there was a huge difference in that.
Yeah, and I'll close the question by saying, you know, a point Nick brought up too on the Portrait Session podcast was that even in his experience with Bay Photo, he believes their metal prints are a little bit softer or a little bit sharper than Miller's prints are. And I actually did notice that our 24 by 30 inch metal print that we did with Miller's was a little bit soft now that he mentioned it. And I would like to give Bay Photo a try just to see whether it is truly sharper.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. Another point, Jeff, you mentioned about canvas prints. We really are going off on this. We would love to print. I really enjoy it. You said you do your canvas prints at Costco. Yeah. I've tried, maybe four or five different labs for canvas prints, and there's a lot less difference than I see with the paper prints. I think it's because the canvas, just by the nature of a canvas, soaks so much ink that there was not a whole lot of difference between them. And so when I print, I usually use Canvas on Demand. I've used Easy Prints, and I really got good results from everybody. And so I usually go with a good lab, you know, like Canvas on Demand that's well known. And then I just go with the cheapest one. I haven't had a bad canvas yet. So I'm a little bit more lenient when it comes to that as opposed to the photo paper prints. All right. Well, I guess this is in a similar vein. The question that I saw was, and I think a lot of this will resonate with a lot of you listening, is my pictures are always soft looking. I use a low ISO, a fast shutter speed. I use a tripod a lot of the times, but the pictures are soft. What am I doing wrong? And that was also submitted by Anonymous. People are very concerned about getting known with their photography questions. I've worked through this with hundreds, thousands of students over the last few years. And Darren, I know you have as well. Yep. Sharpness is something that we see a ton of problems with. If all of your photos are soft, something's wrong. Something in your process is not right. It may be something going on in post-processing that you're, you know, exporting the photo too small or something. If you're not technically inclined, it could be kind of an obvious mistake like that that you just don't notice if nobody's sat next to you and showed it to you. And really, if it's something like that, you really do just need somebody more experienced to sit down and work through the issue for you. Sharpness is one thing that it can get really frustrating if you don't have somebody right next to you helping. That is something that we offer help with in our online classes, as well as just get a portfolio review, $39 on improvephotography.com, and you can submit 7 or 14 of your photos, and one of us, one of the podcast hosts, you can even pick on some of the packages. We'll look through your photos and record a little 10-minute mini podcast for you, going through each of the photos, reviewing them for you, and that's a great place to ferret out some of these problems if you're having a sharpness issue or something like that. Because it can be caused by a lot of different things. But the other answer, and this one's a little bit frustrating because it's a money thing, but it very well could just be the lens, and that's all there is to it. You know, if you have several lenses and none of them can shoot a sharp picture, I doubt that's the issue. But I was working with my brother, Mike, who's a hobbyist photographer, but really enjoys it. And last year, and he just said, all my photos are soft. All my photos are soft. And I sat down and looked through them with him. And yeah, sure enough, they just were soft, and all of his camera settings were right and everything. And I said, it's time for a new lens. And he went and picked up a nice Canon 70-200, and his pictures are looking great, tack sharp. And he told me the problem just went away right away. You don't have to spend a ton of money to get a sharp lens, but there are definitely lenses that are better than others, but there are bargains out there. So, go to improvephotography.com, look for that recommended gear, and we have some good lenses. Or again, do a portfolio review or a class with us, and we can help you make that choice so you don't waste a lot of money going to the wrong lenses.
And you have that lens finder coming up soon, right?
And we have the lens finder coming up soon. It's like almost daily I'm getting pings from photographers saying, by the way, is that ready yet?
All right, I'll stop asking.
It has been a long time coming, but I've invested a lot of money into this project, and more than a year. It's been a huge, way bigger of an undertaking than I thought. And I think maybe I would even dare to say about a month out. We're getting close. Some great questions, but also some interesting news items in the news this week. Jeff, tell us about ShutterSpots.
So it's a new app that's just released, I believe it's just this week. And it goes with in the background tons and tons of smartphone apps. This one is iOS only right now. I know they have plans to expand on it. The idea is it is a way to find interesting photo spots while you're on the go. So we've talked before on the podcast about prepping, getting ready before you go on a trip, finding the spots, getting your itinerary going. And that's still, I think, the way to go. But the idea of this one would be that maybe you don't have to do that at some point. It's not ready yet. But at some point, you could just pull up the app and say, hey, here I am. I have the next 3 hours. Where should I go to try to see interesting shots? And I say it's not ready yet because I just tried it today. And in Utah, here I am. And you use the GPS data. And it said, hey, the closest attraction for you is in Texas, 1,000 miles away. And I know there are good spots in between here and Texas. So
also, every time I open the app, it just crashes.
Oh, really?
There are some issues.
You have like the worst technical luck.
I guess. I don't know. It just crashes. Terrible. And we're both on iPhones. Anyway, I think it's good. I think there's still a need for this. There are a lot of solutions on, you know, kind of mapping, find photo locations, but I haven't found one yet that's like perfect that I can say like, ah, this is it. The best that I've found yet is one that you recommended to me, Jeff, and that's 500px.com/maps. Yeah. That's been really good. Trey Ratcliffe's Stuck on Earth is fine if you want to spend a lot of time because it just grabs all the geotagged photos from Flickr. And so it has just so much just crap on there that's not really a photo location. It's just a photo somebody took there, you know, maybe somebody on a black background in a studio, you know, just kind of silly things that are not photo locations or photos that just frankly aren't that good. So I don't love that one as well. But I think there's, hopefully it'll be ShutterSpots, that hopefully something will come out and get us a good solid database all around the world of excellent photo spots. Also, we wanted to give a little update on Lightroom CC. We've been complaining rather loudly on Improved Photography about all of the bugs in Lightroom CC. And it's been, it's been about a month now since it came out. And so I wanted to get an update from everybody to see how we're doing. For me personally, it's been terrible. On both my laptop and my desktop, two very different machines in terms of power and everything else. And I'm just getting constant crashes, photos that just reload and loop, just all kinds of issues. I have one photo that I took in Italy, and that's where I've been the last couple weeks that I wasn't on the podcast, that every time I edit it, it switches to the camera process version of whatever it was, 2004 or something. And so it shows me the old recovery sliders and stuff, the recovery and fill light sliders. Remember those? Mm. And I can't change the process version. It's just stuck. There are so many bugs. It's been driving me absolutely crazy. And I've been messaging with Nick and he's been having tons of problems. I wish he was on the podcast today to back me up. But how is it going for you guys?
So I haven't had any trouble from the beginning, but I think my hardware profile on the PC I've got just happens to fit into the nice little groove of the changes that they made so that it works. So I think that, from the reaction and things I've been reading, the different forums, I've been in the Adobe forums a lot trying to research what is causing it as I'm considering what to write for the site and how to recommend people to do things. And you're not alone, Jim. There's tons of people who are having struggles and it's a lot of different hardware profiles. The developers are gathering a lot of information about it. It feels like they have a niche area where it works. And if it doesn't, it's really bad.
Yeah. Very, very frustrating to me. How about you, Darren?
You've actually, with your issues, it scared me to only put it on my laptop just because I want it on the machine that I take on the go, and it's not going to be make or break if I have to wait to get home to do my editing. And we actually had a user on Improved Photography named Denny comment on the last show, and I titled the last show Lightroom's Redemption, and I think that was just more tailored to being redeeming factors, me trying to find positive things about Lightroom when talking with Jeff and Nick about it. But I think it still has a long way to go. And if they're going to be giving us this monthly subscription, they should definitely not be using us as guinea pigs, because as we were talking prior to recording, we were saying that we need this to be at least a stable platform to operate on. And it scares me enough that I don't have it installed on my iMac. I just leave it on my MacBook Pro for now.
Yeah, I'm fine with the subscription. But if it's going to be an app that's continuously updated and they're going to send us updates regularly, I need the updates to work. I can't do this thing where it's like, I'm in Italy, I have a terrible internet connection, so I can't download the previous version and go back a version. I need it to work. I think that we can expect that much when we're all paying a subscription. That the updates that are coming, they really do need to be stable. if I were Adobe, I would go back and start a beta test. You know, have some people on the subscription that choose to be the beta testers, and they're always one step ahead, and we can ferret those bugs out before it gets sent out to millions of photographers who are relying on it for their business. It needs to just work. And it's been a month now, and we haven't seen a bug fix. Very, very frustrating. Well, enough of that. But I will say one thing. Speaking of redeeming factors in Lightroom, I really have liked the updates that are in there. Like, it's cool. If I could have designed this update, what they would have worked on, I would have worked on these features, which is awesome. And another one that I did not know was in there until I listened to Photo Taco this morning from Jeff Harmon is that they added in the preferences that, you know, the little tiny little icons, little graphics on the thumbnails in Lightroom. Well, if you click on those, and sometimes it gets to be in a bunch of those little icons, and you got to like get right in between them to click on the photo, because otherwise it'll just bring up that tool that you're on. Anyway, they have a new preference in Lightroom that you can have it so those are not clickable icons. Thank you. I have been wanting that. And I did not know that was in that update. So thank you, Jeff, for putting out that episode of Photo Taco. That was great.
Yeah, I liked it.
All right. Well, we want to talk a little bit about some of photographers' rights issues, as well as some of the other photography-centric things coming up this week. But before we go on, we want to take a minute to thank Squarespace for helping us make this podcast possible. One of the things that I love about Squarespace is that it's easy to update. The tools are right there for you. It doesn't matter how technically inclined you are. It really is very easy to get started with Squarespace. My photos from Italy, as soon as I got to Wi-Fi that worked, I sat down at the airport, I exported my photo from Lightroom, and bang, it was on my portfolio site. And I just love that. There are a lot of platforms out there, and they all have their benefits and drawbacks. But the one thing that really attracts me to Squarespace is how quick and easy it is to use without messing with any of the technical stuff. Plans start at just $8 a month, and I know a lot of the podcast hosts are loving Squarespace. Darren, I know you're a Squarespace user. Nick's a Squarespace user. I've been completely satisfied with this one area of my photography. So you can check it out. Starts at just $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you start if you sign up for 1 year. Start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, be sure to use the offer code IMPROVE, and that'll get you 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Well, we want to talk a little bit about photographers' rights. It seems like this is just an issue that's been coming up repeatedly in the news for U.S. listeners and around the world. Jeff, what are some of the stories that you've been noticing coming through that have brought this topic up for you?
Yeah, I couldn't wait for you to get back from your traveling so you could help me understand what I should expect as a photographer with rights. So there's been a couple of different stories covered in some of the photography media outlets, where one was a photographer who he's decided that he wants to go and make sure that at least people understand what their rights actually are, especially the law enforcement side, making sure that they're aware of what they can and cannot do. He was out at a national park, and it was just a beautiful scene, and he was taking a family photo. It wasn't a commercial thing. He did have like a reflector out and a nice L lens on his camera. And a law enforcement guy came up and said, "Do you have a license to be doing commercial shooting here?" And he said, "I'm not doing commercial shooting. This is of my family. I'm just taking a photo." And he gave him a really hard time. And he said, "Well, just put the reflector away so you don't quite look so official." And the guy's like, "What?" And, you know, if it was me, just because I feel like I don't understand enough about what all of my rights are as a photographer, I would have complied probably. I would have said, "Okay, I'll do that." Just because I don't want to cause trouble. And I didn't know, you know, what to stand on. So I wanted to get your take about, well, how would you do, respond to that? And what are the rights? Then there's another article that was published just today. Petapixel had a really good article about outlining in the U.S. what a photographer's rights actually are. They have kind of a list that we should probably go through to talk through the details.
Yeah, very, very good intro to this topic. well, I guess one thing that's I'm sure I'll make some people mad by saying this, but I'm going to say it because in my experience it's been true. And I'm absolutely positive, guaranteed this is not true of all of them, but it is true of a lot. When we're talking about agency police, you know, we're talking about the wildlife rangers, the Park Service rangers, we're talking about fish and game, those agency police officials, they don't catch people very often. You know, they do a lot of crowd control, they do a lot of good work, but it's rare that they actually catch somebody committing a crime. You know, maybe once a year, a fish and game guy will catch somebody with one too many ducks in his bag, you know. It's rare that they catch somebody. And so when I was a prosecutor, I saw a lot that those agency police, especially like fish and game, they would catch somebody for the slightest offense and they would like want to throw the book at them. I mean, just insane charges. And all the prosecutors in the office would be like, yeah, no, actually, let's just give them like an hour of community service. It's pretty minor. And so what I often see from these kind of agency officials is, one, they may not know the rules of photography. And two, it's rare that they kind of catch somebody, you know, it's rare that they're going to find like a film crew out there, you know, filming a movie. And so often it ends up that they are trying to enforce the rules on situations where it was never intended to happen. And so I think this is a perfect example of it, is the article that you mentioned, that this photographer, and you can see in the background, there's nobody anywhere close. It's not like he's bugging people that they can't enjoy the space where they are in the park. I mean, there's nobody in the way at all. He's not bugging anything. And yet the law gets enforced on him. That probably the only intention was to stop, you know, a Hollywood movie from just setting up shop in Yellowstone and getting in everybody's way. So I think there's a big disconnect between the way that the rules are made and the way that the rules are implemented. And lawmakers are having a very difficult time defining exactly what that means. Often it is that they just write commercial photography. And so if I'm there, as I'm a landscape photographer and I hike into Yellowstone, well, is it commercial photography? Well, yeah. I mean, I'm going to sell the photos. I'm going to use it on the Facebook page to advertise improved photography. It's commercial. But I obviously, I'm not the use case that the law was intended to prevent. So it ends up with some unintended, very negative consequences. And so it is difficult for us as photographers, because often we can't justify our actions based on the law, because the law is just written so overbroad that it's just commercial photography. Another use case that we're really struggling with right now is we're doing these the photography meetups, these free workshops all over the world. And so like we're going to Zion National Park, we're going to Southern Utah later this year. Well, we have like 70 people going and a ton of cars. And so whenever we get in big groups like that, even groups of a third that size, the park rangers get really interested and they go up and say, what's going on here? And they start to give you a hassle just because you're in a group, even though it's completely free. Nobody's making money off this. It's just a group of photographers that want to go together. But every stop you make in through the park, a new park ranger stops you and hassles you because the rules are not clear. And there's just nothing we can do right now as photographers to get around that, because the laws are written overbroad. And the local officials that are trying to enforce the laws are just enforcing the laws as they're written overbroad in cases that they really, I think we can all agree, are just kind of silly. Darren, what do you think about that?
Well, when you talked about the group, it actually brought me back to Oregon, because we were standing in the California side in the Redwoods and a park ranger pulled up and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, we're on a photography workshop. And the first question that came out of his mouth was, you know, do you have a permit? And I said, no, here's my business card, because I didn't have an improved photography one on me. Go to improvephotography.com/workshops. You can see that it says free, free, free all over them. And it's a free workshop where everyone just paid their own expenses to get out here. And if you have any questions, shoot me an email at info@improvephotography.com. photography, and boom, I didn't hear a response to him at all. I think that he did his research and just decided to leave it alone. So would you say that that's probably an appropriate response, just to make sure that you're clarifying what you're doing and kind of knowing your rights, which we touched upon?
Well, I think that's a good response, but the problem is that, you know, there's a different park ranger every stop. And so it really becomes a big problem. Like, we're trying to just go enjoy a national park that our taxes pay for, and then we pay for again when we get to the gate. And we're just happen to be in a group, and you get hassled every single stop just because you have a camera in your hand. And the commercial photography is the worst way that they could possibly write this into a law, because, I mean, let's think about it. I go out to Yellowstone and I take a picture of a landscape. If I'm just using it for my personal enjoyment, that's fine. If I'm doing it for a commercial use, they want me to pay a permit. What difference did it make? Did I impact the park somehow more because I'm going to sell the photo? No. Did I change anybody else's experience? No. I can understand if you're going to get in people's way, you need to close down an attraction so you have everything open for your while you're filming a movie. Totally makes sense. You should have to pay for a permit. But what we're doing as photographers so rarely, I believe, should really require any kind of permitting. It's just gone way out of control. And it's the federal government. It's also states. We've seen a lot of states writing this kind of legislation as well. It really has become a mess. And as you travel around the world to different countries, the problems only multiply because you don't know what the issues are in each particular country. Becoming a photographer is getting a lot more difficult, and it's being abused by special interest groups as well. You know, a farmer or a nuclear power plant will have their special interest that they want the law written that you can't take a picture of a farm because they don't want, you know, some animal lover PETA member to go take a picture of, you know, abuse of chickens or whatever in a coop. And so they make a law that says no photography of farms. And then it just stops photography dead in its tracks. Cameras are everywhere, and these laws cannot be written in such an overbroad manner. Jeff, thoughts on that?
So, well, I wanted to go over what Petapixel listed in their article about the rights. So they had five bullet points that come from the ACLU. And I wanted to get your take on them and suggestions on what photographers could do to make it so that these exchanges with law enforcement, especially the agency level law enforcement, are not heated or can be productive. And, you know, the one you mentioned, Oregon, sounds like that worked out really well. It couldn't have, but, you know, that guy chose to accept your answers and move on. But here's the five. Here's I think it was five bullets. First one is, when in public spaces where you are lawfully present, you have the right to photograph anything that is in plain view. The second point?
No, not true.
Oh, really?
I'm calling that not true. Okay, so it's important to say that the source of this is the ACLU, which are crazy rights advocates.
Sure.
A lot of times they do very good work. A lot of times they do work that I don't agree with, but they're trying to advocate this as being the right. I don't know if they're necessarily saying this is your right, because there are obviously sometimes that you can't. There are some states that you can't photograph police. Again, there are some states where you can't photograph farm operations. So even if you are in plain view in a public place, it does not necessarily mean you can photograph anything you want. I believe that should be the law, but it's not always.
I think they cover that in point five, but that's why I wanted to go over it with you so that I knew whether this was, you know, something I should take or not.
Let's put an asterisk on point one.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Number two, when you are on private property, the property owner may set rules about the taking of photographs.
Yes. So, may set rules. Not that they may set all rules or any rules, but they may set rules. Yes. So for example, in some states, it would be legal for me I guess we've seen, what are examples we see? Ah, yeah, we see examples of somebody putting a hidden camera on their body and going into an abortion clinic or talk to a politician or something like that. Something where they want to do kind of secret camera. In some states it's legal, some states not legal, whether you're on private property or not to do that. Yes, they can set rules. They cannot set any rule they feel like. There may be some rights about that photographers have to photograph, even if they're on private property.
Okay, so the next two are the ones I really wanted to know the most. Police officers may not confiscate or demand to view your digital photographs or video without a warrant.
Almost always true, yes. There could be exceptions to that, but almost always true. So it's the same with any police search, because if they're going to look at your photos, that's a search. And we have the right against unreasonable search and seizure. Now, unreasonable is the key. Right. Now, generally, if a police officer is going to do a search of your camera, which seeing the photos would be a search of the camera, they're going to need a warrant. There are certain exceptions to that, if there was, you know, you just barely took a picture of the Boston bomber running away, and the police officer needs to see who it is. It's necessity. It's urgent. They've got to look at it. He could just grab it and look at it. Some kind of very niche thing. But yes, generally, they cannot look at your photos without a warrant. And so that's what I often see. I'm jumping ahead to the next one. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, the next one is very closely related, that they can't delete any of them. They can't make you go delete any of them.
Yes, that is true. Absolutely not. I can't think of any circumstance where that could happen. Even with a warrant, I cannot see how a judge could ever order that to be deleted.
Okay, so that's good to know, because then I would now respond to anyone who would stop me about it and say, I know my legal right is that I get to keep these photos, so I'm not going to delete any of them.
And that's what we often see from like rent-a-cops and security guards. Yeah, take a picture of a building in New York and the rent-a-cop comes up to you and says, hey, you need to delete your photos. And you say, I'll leave right now, but don't delete your photos, not for any police officer, much less a rent-a-cop.
Yeah. Okay, and then the last one. Police officers may legitimately order citizens to cease activities that are truly interfering with legitimate law enforcement operations.
Yes, that's true. And this is often interpreted very broadly. If a police officer is making an arrest, obviously if your camera's like covering the hands of the person that they're arresting, obviously you're impeding the police officers from doing that. Photographers aren't going to do that. Sometimes you're 5 feet away though. And that's where it gets in a sticky situation is, you're not within arm's reach of the police officer. And so you just start shooting. Well, a police officer could still order you a very long distance between you and photographing the police officer, because he needs to feel safe. And if he's arresting somebody, he needs to make sure nobody can reach up to his gun. Nobody could attack the police officer from behind. So they could order you to be pretty far away from what's happening. So if a police officer orders you to move away, because this is often interpreted very broadly and you do not want an obstructing charge. Yeah. A lot of people get obstructing charges. So you do have to be very careful with that. Under most situations, a police officer can't order you to not take the picture, just to not get in the way. And that depends dramatically on the state, the city, exactly where you are. But I would say the general rule is, yes, you can photograph police officers. Yes, all the time. You got to be very careful that you're not even close to impeding what's happening.
Okay, and so one more that wasn't included as a point, but I wanted to get your take on. The next paragraph down in Petapixel's article, they had a statement from an attorney who said, despite common misconception, the following subjects can be photographed: accidents, children, celebrities, bridges, residential and public buildings, industrial facilities, and public utilities, transportation facilities, super fun sites. I don't know what those are. Criminal activity.
But it sounds super fun.
And law officers. So feel free to snap those pictures without fear.
Yeah, that's true. You know, obviously there are going to be some restrictions on how that can be done. But in general, yeah. You know, can I photograph a celebrity? Yes. Can I impede them walking down the street? Well, maybe not. Maybe at that point I become a nuisance. You know, so there are limitations to the way you can do it. But can you in general photograph those? Yes, I would totally agree with that statement. And I guess we always have to add in when we talk about this kind of thing, I am an attorney. I'm not your attorney. And it is different in every country, in every state, and in cities that may have different ordinances on this as well. So you need to know your local laws and talk with an attorney licensed in your jurisdiction.
All right. So then the biggest question I had is, how would you respond then if the agency cop comes on the beach in the national park and says, hey, you can't do that here without a commercial license?
Well, for me, unfortunately, he's probably right, because every photo I take is commercial. I'm going to use almost every single picture I take commercially. And so for me, under a lot of the national park rules, a lot of the public land rules, he's probably right. And as annoying as it is, as ridiculous as it is, for me, he's probably right. For most photographers, that most of their photos are not going to be used commercially, I'd say buzz off.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One thing I will say is I don't think the right answer is to just bow to whatever police officers say or any kind of official says about where you can or can't take pictures. That only is making the problem worse. Like, we know it's going to be an issue in Southern Utah, and so we're figuring it out right now. We're talking to the national parks. We're talking to the state parks that we're going to. We're telling them right now what's happening, and then we're going to print off the emails so that we have a record of exactly what's happening. if we were to just go, even if we were within our legal rights, it's just going to cause issues, and we're going to be fighting it the whole time. It drives me crazy that that's the case. We're just taking pictures, but that is the case. And so I think by working it out beforehand, you know, calling up wherever you're going to be and just finding out what the issues are, then I think that's the very best thing that you can do, because then you're kind of forcing the agency to make a decision. And if you don't agree with it, you can fight it out where you can look things up and do it in a calm manner. You know, when you're talking to the cop right there, a lot of times we get cops on power trips. And again, I'm not anti-cop. There are some wonderful police officers that deal with way more than they should. But it does frustrate me when they're really infringing on the rights of photographers, not just in the United States, but around the world. This has become a big issue.
Well, I think we've spent enough time on this topic, but I did want to bring up quickly that Brian McGuckin shared with the IP team earlier today that he has an episode scheduled with the guy that the story is about from Petapixel, who was approached by the enforcement officer and asked to stop. And so he's going to be going into a lot more detail on this for a lot longer discussion.
And that's the Thoughts on Photography podcast from Brian McGuckin. If you haven't yet subscribed to all the shows, you're missing out big time on a lot of what we're doing. Jeff Harmon has the Photo Taco podcast. Darren, Nick, and Erica are doing the Portrait Session podcast. And Brian is doing Thoughts on Photography. So spend just a second, go to whatever you're listening to this on right now, and go subscribe on your phone. If you're on iOS, you can just use the podcast app. If you're on Android, go to Stitcher, or go to Dogcatcher is my favorite for Android, and just search the name of those shows and you'll be subscribed. It'll come to your phone every single week. You don't have to go to the website and listen to these. All right. In every episode, we want to give a resource, a doodad that we like and have found helpful that week. Darren, let's go to you first. What's your doodad of the week?
Mine is actually just to minimize some gear and just remove clutter from your life. I think that it's actually made me a little bit more of a creative and productive photographer by cutting down redundancy. And it's also helped out from a financial standpoint to hawk some of the lenses that are redundant, ones that are collecting dust. And it's actually kind of forcing me to be a little bit more challenged. Like if I don't have the lens that I had within reach, I'll put one lens on, go walk around town, do some street photography, and stick with that one lens versus having two on me that would either weigh me down and you know, maybe just be make me a little bit more of a lazy photographer. So I say less is more.
Very good. Jeff?
Mine's going to be sound really strange, but stick with me for a second here. I'm recommending something called Music to Code By, and this is something for computer programmers when they code. but
Jeff, so you've given us some nerdy suggestions before.
This is about
Music
the top
to Code
of it, right?
By. This is starting to get pretty nerdy.
I know. Okay, so here's how it fits in. I promise it will. Okay. A few episodes ago in the Portrait Sessions podcast, there was some discussion about time management and how it's so hard to stay focused when you've got Facebook pinging or your phone pinging or whatever's going on, all these things that can distract you away, and you have 300 photos you need to get through in editing and you've got to get it done in the next 2 hours, and everything else is trying to steal your attention away. So they were talking, you know, Darren and the others were talking about ways they were working through that. And the way this fits in then is a suggestion here would be you can close Facebook, you can put your phone in the other room for a little bit. And then this music is specifically developed to help you ultra focus in on what you're doing. So it doesn't have it. It's very research based. The guy who created it was a programmer, but he did a ton of research because he was really interested in the topic. He was also a musician, and he researched over many years the things that are distracting in music versus the things that help you focus in music, and how long you are actually effective at focusing. And the studies that he did, the research he did, led to most people can only be that focused for 25 minutes, and then they need to go get up, they need to walk, they need to go get a drink, they need to go do something else for a little bit before coming back and doing another 25-minute session. So his tracks are 25 minutes long. They are absent the distracting types of sounds that break your concentration. And then when the music stops, you know it's time to go do something else.
Very, very interesting. Well, let's listen to a couple seconds of it. So you're saying this is music we can listen to like while we're post-processing and stuff?
Yep.
All right,
Darren, cue up the music. Let's listen to this for a second.
All righty.
All right, it's like smooth jazz meets synthesizer.
Right. Well, there's three different flavors of it, so it's not all the same. But I don't know. I've tried it, and it just melts into the background enough that it's effective.
Oh, Blue Track. I like that one. All right. I could get used to this Blue Track. All right, I'm gonna try. I've got to post process a bunch of photos from Italy. I'm post processing to Blue Track. Good suggestion.
So then it can block out all the other noises. You don't hear the buzzes or the beeps from the, you know, whatever else is going on. And you're going to focus for 25 minutes.
I like it. Good suggestion.
Very cool. Maybe I won't have to put my phone under the couch cushion while I'm editing photos. So I really like this.
Yeah. Well, I went to Italy this last week, and it was an awesome trip. I went with my wife, and we spent 10 days in Tuscany and Cinque Terre and Venice. And I was filming for the new beginner class that is going to be coming out soon. I got a lot of irons in the fire right now. And if you've already bought the beginner class, don't worry. It's coming to you for free. You'll always get the updates to the classes. But this is going to be a pretty big update to the beginner class. And while we were there, I found a cool S-curve in a city just in the road. You know, it's just kind of a curvy little part of the road. And so I wanted to photograph that. And so I wanted to get up high. So I looked up, and there was a mountain next to us, and there were these steps going up it. And it was so steep. It took us about 35 minutes climbing up these steps. And we literally were on all fours climbing up to the top of this mountain. And then I wanted tail lights going on the street, but there were no cars. It was this like tiny little town in Italy. I'm way, way high above the city. I was using my 70-200 to really, really zoom in there so I could get just this little gentle curve in the street. And so Emily was such a good diehard photographer spouse. She climbed back down the mountain with my headlamp, turned on the little red light, and then was just walking running up and down this S curve in the road, shining the light back up at me so it would look like tail lights, like cars were driving. It was really funny. And then she attracted the attention of a local restaurant owner who helped her run up and down the street with the red light. And then the cops came by. They were interested in it and started really grilling her on what was happening. And she was like, oh, no, this is going to turn into an Amanda Knox thing. And it was really, really fun. But the biggest thing that I learned in Italy was I've got to pack even lighter. Every time I go on a trip, I say, I'm going to cut one more thing out. And I did. And still, it was just so much weight to be carrying around. When you're talking about a heavy 7200, 24 to 70, Tamron 15 to 30, a full frame body, a tripod, and a ball head, it's heavy. It's a lot of weight that you're carrying around as you're trying to backpack through Italy. So one thing that I'm going to recommend is my tripod, which I've mentioned before as my dream tripod, and I'm still loving it. It is the Faisal CT3442. I know we don't really do redos on the doodads of the week, but this one is worth mentioning again. It's so lightweight, very stable. In fact, I talked with I communicated with some of the people at Really Right Stuff today, and I said, hey, I would love to recommend your tripods to the readers of Improved Photography because I've played with them before and they are rock solid, really good quality, but they're just too heavy. Do you have anything that can compete even close to the weight of this Faisal? And not even close, not even within a pound and a half of the weight of the Faisal. And it's solid. It's been a great, great tripod for me. So the Faisal CT3442 has been an excellent tripod for me. Definitely recommended. So, and you know, for a carbon fiber professional tripod, it's really reasonably priced at about $300. I know that's expensive, and I know there are cheaper tripods, but when we're talking about professional carbon fiber, lightweight travel tripods, this is a really good deal. And also, we've been doing a contest on Instagram. I've been a lot more active on Instagram. You can follow me at Jim Harmer is my handle. A lot of you are following me on Instagram, and it's been fun. I've been replying to all the comments. There are a lot fewer people in the community on Instagram than there are on our Facebook page. And so I've been able to do a lot more one-on-one kind of conversations with people on there. But we did a contest using the hashtag Improve Photography, and we got a ton of submissions for the grand prize of my favorite box of cereal, Captain Crunch. And at least my favorite box of cereal for the moment. And also, we're going to take the photo and we're going to edit it, all of the hosts of Improved Photography, and edit it in our different ways and then do a YouTube video of that. So we're really anxious to get that out. And the winner that we've chosen is Sandy Durow. That's D-O-R-A-U. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. From Las Vegas, submitted a really cool photo that we'll link to in the show notes. Sandy, if you would email us at prize@improvephotography.com and let us know your address, and if you'd also send us the photo so that we could do the YouTube video, and then we'll let you know how we all post-processed your photo differently, just to get some different ideas going. I think that'll be an interesting video. Thank you for your download of the Improved Photography podcast and your support of Improved Photography, and we will see you in another 7 days.